If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today we've got the final episode in our series on Britain's greatest prime ministers.
Hello, and welcome to our new series profiling some of Britain's most important prime ministers. I'm Matt Elton, deputy editor of BBC History Magazine. It's 300 years since Robert Walpole became Britain's first prime minister. To mark this seismic moment in the nation's political history, we asked a series of leading historians to each nominate the two leaders that they believe achieved most during their time in Number 10. So I'm delighted to be joined by Sir Anthony Seldon, who is the author of a new book, The Impossible Office, which charts the history of the Prime Minister, and also the presenter of a new radio series on BBC Radio 4. Anthony, I wondered if I could start by asking you, you're someone who, as you say in your book, has spent decades thinking about and writing about Prime Ministers. What do you think is our most common misconception about the office?
That the office is, and very nice to be on, by the way, that the office is getting more and more powerful. You know, I was at school in the 70s and my A-level politics essays were about the Prime Minister becoming presidential, went to uni, came to London, was at LSE, did a doctorate. The supposition was that the PM wasn't very powerful back then. Why not? Because there was a monarch. And the PM has become steadily more powerful. The office has got bigger and bigger. That bigger means good. And that now, we have, pick out whoever you want. Thatcher, Blair, Johnson, in effect, a president. And of course, it's absolute nonsense.
So if we head back to the very first days of the office, when and why did the post emerge?
Because Britain had its traumas in the 17th century, a civil war that resulted in the execution of the king, revolution, replacement of the monarchy in 1660. But it still wasn't a constitutional monarchy, but it was moving from an absolute monarchy, as we saw, for example, in France with Louis XIV, it was moving in the direction of a constitutional monarchy. Then in 1688, 1689, the Catholic James II replaced by William of Orange and Mary. And again, Parliament becoming more and more powerful and limiting, restricting the freedom of manoeuvre of the monarch. And then in 1714, the Hanoverians, George I, didn't speak English, German, for goodness sake, on the crown of Britain, very upsetting, alien to many people. And by now, we'd had the Septennial Act, the Parliament coming into effect every 7 years, 3 years before that, then 7 years, and a sense that power had moved decisively in the direction of a constitutional monarchy, and that the parliament was essential. And George I needed their own person in parliament to do their business, to get their acts through and to get their finance through. And this was the beginning. So in 1721, he asked Robert Walpole to be First Lord of the Treasury. Then, now, on the 3rd of April, when it happened, it wasn't a big deal. There weren't fireworks over London. It was just an event that achieved bare minimum of notice in the press of the day. And, of course, there had been antecedents. Look at Thomas Cromwell, Thomas Wolsey before him, William Robert Cecil under Elizabeth I, figures with many of the powers of the Prime Minister, but their authority rested on the monarchy, on the crown. And that was different because Walpole and his successors depended on the crown, yes, but also on Parliament, and progressively on Parliament.
Your book opens with an imagined conversation between Walpole, the first Prime Minister, and Johnson, the incumbent, the current Prime Minister. What do you think we would make of Robert Walpole if we could talk to him today?
Well, of course, in that conversation, Boris Johnson is talking to him. It's not imaginary. It really happened. He really did invite Walpole along on the 3rd of April 2021 to this celebration dinner with just both men. And I think we would see many echoes of him in Boris Johnson. They went to the same school, Eton. Well, that's a surprise. They went on to university together. They were big men, larger than life, extrovert characters, manipulators of media, manipulators of other people, lovers of extravaganza. They both lived at Downing Street with a woman who Walpole later married, and Boris Johnson's fiancée, Carrie Symonds, who's, they were both 25 years younger, both nearly died in their first year in office. Both came to power through the chance event of the South Sea bubble with Walpole and Brexit for Johnson. And without that, they wouldn't have happened. So I think we'd find him very recognisable, Matt, in answer to your question. We'd think, blow me down. which is which? And yet, you know, there are differences too.
Do you think it says something that they are so comparable?
Yes, it does. And getting back to your first question about the head of government seeming to be so powerful, I mean, in many ways, this comes out in their conversation in the book. Boris Johnson recognises to his chagrin, to his discomfort, that actually Walpole had many powers that he didn't have. I mean, and they included being Chancellor of the Exchequer, a post the PM had till 1841. He was in charge of the Treasury. I mean, what would Johnson give to be in charge of the Treasury? Walpole and his successors were leaders of the House of Commons. They dominated Parliament. They dominated elections. They dominated patronage. They oversaw foreign policy. They kept the country solvent and safe. And the idea that George I, the monarch of the day, was all powerful is absolute nonsense. In many ways, Elizabeth II has far more authority over the country, certainly, than George I had.
Why was there a period of uncertainty immediately after Walpole, and how did that uncertainty get resolved?
Well, we always project backwards. This is the great thing that students recognise at some point when they're studying history, that it wasn't all preordained and inevitable. And looking back over 300 years, we can see, well, this is the first Prime Minister 300 years ago, very splendid, a steady path to the present day. But of course, it wasn't at all like that. I mean, Walpole, had he not survived for 21 years, the office might have disappeared. Had he died, then maybe there would have been a resort to earlier arrangements. And after him, there were a succession of 12 prime ministers over the following 41 years, till 1783, most of them very forgettable. Pelham is remembered because he was very long-serving, who followed Walpole Bar One. But you know, and Lord Chatham, father of Pitt, Chatham Pitt the Elder, father of Pitt the Younger, brilliant figure commemorated throughout this country and North America, very well known as a leader, brilliant foreign leader, but not as First Lord of the Treasury. And North is known to many people because he was the figure when Britain lost the 13 colonies and became the United States of America. But, you know, most people, frankly, will be pushed to name most of those figures. And it could have gone either way. The office could have been lost. And it wasn't till Pitt the Younger in 1783 was asked by George. George was fed up with a whole series of people he'd asked. He'd come in, he'd succeeded his grandfather in 1760, determined, age 22, to be his own man, although not to take it back into an absolute monarchy, but to be a more active constitutional monarch, and picking PMs and administrations far more. But he then fell back on Pitt, who was there for most of the time until 1806 as the second longest serving prime minister of the 55 in history. And it was again that very length of service of Pitt the Younger that just consolidated the office. When he died in 1806, there was really no going back. The office was a regularised part of the unwritten constitution.
Are there commonalities that we can trace across this 300-year period of the kind of people in office and the experience they have of it?
Yes, they're all ambitious. Most of them, not all of them, deny that they're ambitious. I mean, I think of that. They all have exaggerated notions of their own ability, or most of them have had ability to make changes. They almost all come in and trash their predecessors without quite knowing what they wanted to do. So Lloyd George knew he didn't want to be like the feckless Asquith during the war, and Lloyd George's successors knew they didn't want to be like him with his scandals and mistress, and wanted to have a more high-minded. And Churchill didn't then want to be like Baldwin and Chamberlain, and Attlee didn't want to be like didn't want to be magisterial like Churchill, and then the successors of Attlee didn't want to be mice and introverts like Attlee, you know, all the way through to Thatcher didn't want to be like those feckless again Labour leaders, Wilson and Callaghan, who led the country into decline and let the unions get all over the economy in her eyes.
And what are the things that you think a prime minister needs to have in order to be successful?
They all served for five or more years. You can't be a great PM without that. They've all had a clear agenda, or had the agenda thrust on them, like often a war, Napoleon, or First World War, or Second World War, or they devised their own agendas, like Gladstone, Peel, and Thatcher. They've all benefited from the economy. They've all had landslide victories, all bar one, Pitt the Younger, in Parliament for more than 20 years. Now, these are the factors that have made great PMs essentially are made by great historic events. So, and that's just simply the way it is. But then there are factors, Matt. You know, they all need to have a moral seriousness. They all need to have an iron will. They all need to have a strong constitution. They all need to be highly intelligent, because you can't cope. They all need to be emotionally very intelligent and to be even-tempered. You can't get by as a Gordon Brown or an Anthony Eden shouting at people. It doesn't work in that way. You need to be able to tell a story, to you're the nation's storyteller. You need to be able to teach the nation. You need to be a good orator and use that pulpit. But, you know, you can have all of those better than anyone. But if you're not, don't have those first factors, if you know, you don't have a working majority, you're going to be fighting all the time in Parliament. If you're not there for long enough, you're not going to be able to make a mark. It takes time to bed down change. If you're not there at a great historic moment, you know, you might be a very proficient prime minister steering the country along a nice country lane. But history is made by the strong currents.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And what's happened is the Chancellor has become more and more important. The Foreign Secretary has become less and less important. The PM's tried to be Foreign Secretary with sometimes disastrous results. Suez, Iraq, Libya in 2011. We need to reset the PM.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
So it's partly about history presenting you with a challenge and you rising to meet it. Is that a fair sort of assessment?
Yeah, or failing to rise to it. And it's also about your timing. I mean, had Lloyd George died, as he could easily have done in September 1916, from the influenza plague, he was in Manchester Town Hall and was taken profoundly ill. One of his private secretaries thought he would not make it. Then had that happened, as almost happened to Boris Johnson from COVID-19 exactly 100 years later, had it happened to Lloyd George, Churchill might have taken over. It would have been a disaster for Churchill to have taken over in 1918, as it might have been for if Thatcher had taken over in 1970 or 1965, when Heath, who did take over, became party leader. She wouldn't have judged it then. So to be a great PM is also about, you know, it's about the luck, you know, to be there at the right person at the right time.
Something that you do in the book is you split prime ministers into a series of categories. Rather than attempting to rank the prime ministers, you split them into certain groups. At the top, we have what you call landmark prime ministers. Are there any among those, not to give away the whole list, are there any among those that you'd like to highlight as being particularly strikingly good in some way?
Well, so they were all really good in their own way. And we've had, in the same way with American presidents or French presidents, people love, but not Chinese premiers. People love to rank because there's only one possible victor who is the current person. But, you know, in our country, the very last person that people would normally vote for would be the current person, because we tend to denigrate what we see in the present to some extent. But, you know, that just highlights the absurdity of ranking people. It isn't like ranking the greatest films of all times or the greatest centre forward in football or goal attack in netball or the greatest lead guitarist, because, you know, we can listen back. And if we're talking about the greatest cricketers, we can see what these great Grayson and Bradman and Hutton, what they achieved. You can't do that. We can't relive the life of a premiership. And therefore, to grade them from 1 to 55 is great fun and total drivel. So what I tried to do was just by saying, well, let's look at what they did. So who were the landmark prime ministers? And they're prime ministers subsequently either tried to be like, or they wanted to deliberately distance themselves from, but none could escape their shadow. These are figures of extraordinary agenda changing. They set the pulse, that they make the weather, and they change the office. So Walpole, 21 years, and they're all there for a very long time. Walpole, Pitt, the younger, Peel, who achieved so much, not least the police, Peelers, or Bobbies from Robert Peel, his first name, Palmerston, the great PM of the great power status, Gladstone, Lloyd George, who did so much more than see the First World War to a successful, maybe protracted, but successful conclusion in November 1918. Attlee, who set the country on the course, its whole post-war course, Thatcher, who changed that direction. We haven't had one since. Now, some people have got very upset that I didn't include some people, Harold Wilson, but I mean, for goodness sake, what did Harold Wilson achieve with his landslide victory in 1966? England winning the World Cup was not related to it. There was no causal relationship. And the great liberalisation, social reforms were primarily the work of Roy Jenkins, the Home Secretary. Blair, what did he achieve? The most powerful PM, Labour PM, in Labour's history in terms of election victories, unity of the Labour movement, strong economy, clear sense the country was aching for change after 18 years of Tory rule. And he promised to reshape Britain. So in that second category of important prime ministers who made very important changes, in there is also Stanley Baldwin and Benjamin Disraeli and Gray, the PM at the time of the 1832 Reform Act and the abolition of slavery in 1833. But, it is that's how I do it. I rank them not by a meaningless parlour Christmas afternoon puzzle game of who do we think's best or who do we like most, but what do they actually do? I think there are 9 agenda-changing PMs into which Churchill fits, even though Churchill was more of a statesman. But, a lot of them were statespeople as well as being party people in that top tier. They were taking some of the vestiges of the monarchy in acting as head of state and ruling in the interests of the whole country, not just their party, which made them into the party leader and prime minister.
You interviewed for the radio series a clutch of prime ministers, one of which was Tony Blair, who said something along the lines of prime ministers tend to start at their most popular and least capable and end at their least popular and most capable, which is a really interesting quote. Do you think the lack of formal training for prime ministers is a problem?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But you can only train people willing to learn. And I wonder how much these people are willing to learn. The adrenaline, the shots of adrenaline in that building, it's so distorting, it's so head-bending that, the truth is, and he does understand it mostly, but not, I think, entirely, that it was vanity. He had changed the Labour Party, New Labour, the getting rid of Clause 4. He'd made Labour into a modern electoral, a relatively united force. And he thought he could do the same to the country without studying how to do it. He had a notion in which the sociologist Anthony Giddens was responsible in part of a third way. So neither capitalism nor socialism, but a third way. I mean, it's a bit like a lot of these slogans. Citizens' Charter, classless society, big society, burning injustices, leveling up. I mean, what the heck do they mean? And these are very different from the agenda, the solid agenda that I was talking to you about, that Thatcher, love it or loathe it, had, that Attlee, love it or loathe it, had. They need to learn how to do the job. The truth is that most come to power without knowing how to do the job and without knowing what they want to do, to be honest, to be cruel. The question then is, would they be willing to learn? And that's why they need to listen to people who know and understand how to do it, but not people like Dominic Cummings. And they tend to like people like Dominic Cummings, people who are brilliant campaigners, brilliant minds. They know all the wizardry about polling and getting inside people's heads and getting them to vote for you. But that's a different process. Getting to the top of the mountain is very different from building a house at the top of the mountain.
We've talked a lot about the individual inside number 10. Do you think we need to think more about their partners, their wives, or their husbands in some cases?
Well, there have been two husbands, Dennis Thatcher and Philip May, to Margaret Thatcher, 1979 to 1990, and Philip May, 2016 to 2019. They've all, with very rare exceptions, had influential figures in their lives. And we don't know, rather like we don't know what happened, although Peter Morgan, who wrote Crown, tells us that he knows about it. But we really don't know what happens between the monarch and the PM when they have their weekly audiences. We just do not know. We cannot know. We cannot know what happened between Clementine Churchill and Winston Churchill, or Violet Attlee and Clement Attlee, or indeed between Carrie Symons and Boris Johnson. What we do know is that because of the very intimate nature of the relationship between the PM and their spouse and the secret nature of that, we know that the spouse, or the key relationship, is the one on which they can totally trust. A PM cannot totally trust their own MPs or peers or cabinet, most of whom want their job and think they'll do it better than the PM. One can't totally trust the aides in number 10, who'll have their own agenda and will be fighting each other for access to the PM. The spouse is the one person on whom they can totally trust. By the way, the monarch comes in close to that, because that also is a privileged relationship where information about it, it does not come outside. So, yeah, of course it's interesting. You're interviewing me on the day that obituaries have appeared of Kate Haste, who used to be married to Melvyn Bragg, who was the brilliant writer about the wives to the PMs, or the spouses to the PMs, brilliant broadcaster. So we know that they're very powerful.
Finally, you spend time in the book considering the ways in which the role as it currently stands is flawed and how we might make it better. I wondered if you could just talk us through the ways in which you think the role is a challenge and how it might be improved.
Well, I do think we need to make it better. Every PM since 1945 has been scuttled out for office. Ah, some will say, listening to this, what about Harold Wilson in 1976? That's the one exception where a PM wasn't scuttled out by defeat in a general election or by a coup from the cabinet or by illness. And yet, Harold Wilson, who came back to power in March 1974, having been out of office for 3.5 years when Ted Heath was prime minister, he came back knowing that he didn't have the energy. He was already perhaps having early onset Alzheimer's. He was drinking far too much. His principal private secretary told me many years ago that it was pointless putting papers in front of him after 5 p.m. because he was just too sozzled to take the right decision. So he couldn't have carried on. So they're all scuttled out of office. And in the radio series, I make it out into a cricket match. It's a typical England batting collapse, one after another, coming in with the highest of hopes and extraordinary hyperbole on the doorstep, to be scuttled out in almost no time at all, one after the other. And yet they never learn. So I think we do need to strengthen the office. And we need the Prime Minister to be able to spend more time visiting visiting all parts of the United Kingdom. We need them to spend more time in Parliament. James Callaghan was the last PM who spent significant amounts of time in Parliament. Most PMs loathe Parliament, loathe MPs and the time they have to spend with them. They regard it as a distraction. We are a democracy. We're a parliamentary democracy. That is completely wrong. We need them to spend more time with their families and friends, being normal people, talking to normal people. And to do that, you've got to have a deputy PM, equivalent, if you like, to a vice president or a prime minister. If you're in a presidential system, you have a prime minister, to pick up much of the routine stuff. PMs instead get sucked into being reactive, into crises, into firefighting, next day's headlines. They're not giving the sufficient time clarity to the long-term issues, the big picture, to thinking about forging the agenda-changing policies rather than just the vapid slogans that we discussed or just incremental reactive changes. So all these big issues, Britain's position in the world, are things that the Prime Minister needs to do. And what's happened is the Chancellor has become more and more important, the Foreign Secretary has become less and less important, the PM's tried to be Foreign Secretary with sometimes disastrous results, Suez, Iraq, Libya in 2011. We need to reset the PM, reground them in the Treasury and the core work of, they are first Lord of the Treasury, the Chancellor is second Lord of the Treasury, yet the Chancellor is the most constantly effective limiter, damager of what the PM is trying to do for their own reasons, without any constitutional legitimacy at all. The PM needs to be head of a new body called the National Economic Security Council, which looks after economic and social policy, PM chairing that, not the Chancellor. We need to have a proper deputy PM. Foreign Secretary needs to be re-empowered. Number 10 needs to be much more high-powered, not bigger. It's a resort of weak PMs to think you beef up number 10. Absolute nonsense. It never works. The most successful PM since 1945, Attlee and Thatcher, had small number 10s. You can't say, well, it was different then. I mean, if you're going to say, these are people, Attlee looked after, the British PM oversaw much of the world with the empire at an absolute height at the time. We need to have these changes, to have a far better representation of the composition of the country, ethnically and socially and geographically and in terms of gender, that would inspire confidence. We need to have people who challenge the Prime Minister, not cronies who've been your muckers on the way up in the dark, smoke-crowded rooms, filled rooms on the campaign trail. You need to have really discerning, high-grade people in there. And so, you know, these are ways that would revivify the Premiership. The Premiership is aching for a reappraisal to make it efficient and effective again.
That was Sir Anthony Seldon. His book, The Impossible Office, is published by Cambridge University Press, and you can hear his Radio 4 series, The Prime Minister at 300, on BBC Sounds. That's the final episode in our series on British Prime Ministers. Thank you for listening. You can hear all previous episodes at historyextra.com/podcasts.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow when I'll be talking to Francis Wilson about the controversial author D.H. Lawrence.